Hello, and welcome to an extra special episode of the Historic Present podcast. And today's podcast will be a historic present first. We're going to have the great honour of spending quality time with one of the last remaining survivors of some of the darkest periods in modern history. Having lived through Nazi occupation of her homeland Estonia, after surviving Stalin's rule of terror, we are honoured to introduce to you Hella Patterson. And on International Women's Day, it is all the more special. To share our platform with such an extraordinary storyteller whose first-hand account of being a young girl in such shocking times is profoundly pertinent on today of all days, and we are grateful for her perspective and sharing of memories. Hella? Hello.
Hello, guys. I see my camera's gone off again.
That's right, don't worry about it.
Mm-hmm.
That's okay. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. And I'm very excited to be taking part in this. I'm thrilled having found you on the Times.
Yes.
that was very exciting to read about your drive for history.
And it was for us as well. Well, thank you so much for coming on. So essentially, from what I've gathered through the shortest, briefest of emails, Hella Patterson has lived one of the most fascinating lives through one of the most fascinating periods of modern history of anyone left on planet Earth. So, Hella, I'm going to hand over to you. Let's just speak about your life. Tell us your stories.
Okay. Well, I was born in a little country called Estonia in the Baltic, one of the three Baltic states just south of Finland, west of Russia. So we had been constantly attacked by Russia through the ages, Russia from the east, Germany from the south. And in 1920, Russia signed a non-aggression act against Estonia. Well, in 1939, when the Molotov-Ribbentrop conference took place, Stalin called the Estonian ambassador into his office and said, "Our troops are going to go into Estonia. We'll go in as friends, or if you don't allow that, we'll come in as hostiles." And the ambassador said his knees just gave out under him because he knew what this meant. And sure enough, a huge number of troops, many more than Stalin had claimed, moved into Estonia in 1939, the year after I was born, in the autumn. All windows had to be shuttered, blinds drawn, no light showing from the houses. Nobody could look out at the tanks rolling in. The Russians said they would not interfere with politics, but within months, all the Estonian government from the president onwards had been arrested and whisked away to Siberia. And then a new government was proposed and they were all candidates put up by the Soviets. So they had come in, obviously, because they needed that unfrozen harbor on the Baltic.
Yeah.
And they needed the defense because the Germans could come there and set up their forces, or at the future time, the Americans could come and set up their bases there, and they would all have access to Russia. So within a year and a half, the Russians were gone because the Germans advanced. But they left with such destruction, such inhumanity, that they were an absolute nightmare. They, well, of course, rape is the main way of domination. But they cut women's breasts off. They cut limbs off. And during the last 6 months, they invited the Soviet leaders, invited anybody to form destruction battalions. That means the civilians as well. They could get together, and if they reported that so-and-so was saying nasty things about the Soviet, they could kill him and take his property. It was just total chaos. And they would arrive in the night, mainly, because people would stay up waiting for to see if they were going to have a disturbed night or whether they're going to be dragged out. They would wait until about 4 o'clock in the morning when you were too tired to keep awake. And then they would descend on you. You'd be dragged out of your house in whatever clothes you were in. And that was the last your family saw of you. So there were thousands upon thousands of people who were taken to Siberia and the other countries around them, including my mother's elder brother, who was a customs officer and border guard in Narva, which is the town closest to the Russian border. He, my 17-year-old cousin, and my uncle's wife were taken during that period. My uncle died in Siberia after a couple of years. My cousin was killed on the trains going there. That's what I was told. I don't know whether they stabbed him or simply threw him off the train, because when you're traveling through thousands of miles of tundra with snow all around, you just throw somebody off the train and 20 minutes later they're dead. So that was the closest connection we had. But a lot of destruction was caused by the Soviets. So when the Germans came in, as far as we could see, they were helping to push the Russians back. Now, before the Russians went back, they conscripted Estonian men and said, if you don't fight for us, we will kill your families. And so a huge lot of Estonian men were conscripted into the Russian army. Now in came the German army, and to us they were rescuers.
Yeah.
Because they couldn't possibly be worse than the Soviets had been. So I was told there was dancing in the street. And
God,
the whole thing
that.
Changed.
Dancing in the streets for the Nazis.
Yeah. Yeah, the fact that they were there.
Yeah.
In that we were liberated from the Russians. See, we didn't know what the Germans were doing elsewhere or what Hitler was doing. The forces which came, German forces which came in, yes, they set up prisoner camps in Estonia. Now, Estonia had a really good relationship with Jews. Estonia was the first country which gave Jews autonomy. If there were 4,000, they could set up their own schools, their own newspapers, etc. The only condition on them was to teach Estonian as a second language. So Estonia is marked in the Jewish holy book in the temple in Jerusalem as having a special place. So when the Germans came in, the Jews in Estonia fled to Russia or wherever they could.
Yeah.
And there were very few left in Estonia. But what we didn't know was that Germans were bringing in Jews from other countries and putting them in our concentration camps together with prisoners of war and so on and so forth. But at 5, 6 years old, I knew nothing of this, obviously. So now we had the Germans at our house, at our apartment. When the Russians were in, we had a Russian officer stationed on us, no choice. Now we had a German officer stationed on us, which really upset my grandmother, my mother's mother, because she was made to share a room with my sister and me and give up her room to the officer. But the officer did sneak us packets of biscuits and things like that. And I remember when I had the cold once, I was ill, and he brought in these little treats and so on. And we knew that eventually, as well, they came in 41. By 44, we knew that they would have to withdraw. because Hitler's biggest mistake going into Russia was what saved us. Because they did come in and save us. So now in 44, we know that they're going to be leaving soon. Russians are advancing. And so my parents are all packed. We've got all these suitcases and trunks. Everything is packed, ready to go. And come September, I think it was the 16th. My birthday is on the 10th, and I was 6 years old. And this was about a week after that. It was a Sunday. And our German officer comes and says, I know you've had a sad day. The boy who lived down below had died, and we'd had his funeral. So, but we're withdrawing from Rakvere. The last train will leave at 2 in the afternoon. It will take you to Tallinn, and then from there to Paldiski, and you can go in our ships. The Germans knew that we were terrified of the Russians. They also knew that Germany, losing the war, would need workers because it was destroyed and it would need to be built up again. So the Estonians, Latvians, Lithuanians, Poles, who signed up to become workers in Germany after the war, were given transport out in their warships. So we had to leave everything that had been packed because he said you can only take what you can carry by hand.
What did you bring? What did you bring?
Well, my mother tore up some pictures from photo albums, things like blankets and clothes and things that she was going to leave behind. A few bits of cutlery, silver cutlery, stuff like that. Anything that we could sell that would give us money to buy food. And we sailed a couple of days later from Paldiski. All the ships had about 4,000 people in them. Oh, wow. The men had to stay on deck. The women and children were put into the cabins. I was immensely seasick. We had bombings and we had torpedoes that we had to work our way through in the Baltic.
Oh, wow.
One of the ships, and funnily enough, every Estonian who made that journey thinks that they sailed the same day as the ship Moira, which was torpedoed and sank. Yeah. We all think we stopped to pick up somebody from the sea. It's sort of ingrained in us, and we couldn't possibly have, because it's now been shown that the Moira sailed on a totally different day. But that became our Titanic.
Who was doing the torpedo? Doing the torpedo?
Russians. I mean, we're in German ships. The Germans took us to... Oh, and by the way, there were no night raids when the Germans came. Yeah. If you were arrested, you were arrested in the daytime. You could at least sleep at night. We were taken to Gdansk, which was called Danzig at the time, the Polish
port.
And from Danzig, we were taken to Poznan, where there was a camp for a sort of transient camp where we were for a couple of nights. And from there, we were taken to a place which was called in German Obersitz. The men were taken, we were placed with Polish families. The men were taken and sent to the forests where they were to guard against Russian guerrillas. They never did come across any, but they did occasionally manage to come back into town with a haunch of venison because they shot a deer or something. Food was very, very scarce.
Yeah, I'd imagine.
The Poles, of course, didn't want us imposed on them because that gave them less less food and put many more obligations on them. We weren't going to fight it because this was a matter of life and death for everybody. When any food stuff arrived, word would get around and we'd all go and line up. What we had to do was wear little badges showing our flag colors, like the US president always wears a little badge. And we had the Estonian blue, black and white. And my sister, who was 8 years older, and I would go there. And sometimes the Nazi officers sort of parading up and down would see us at the back and see our badges and drag us to the front just to spite the Poles. So you can see why the Poles weren't happy.
No.
A school was organized, or at least a teacher was organized, to teach the teenagers the German language. Some had already picked it up during the 4 years of occupation, but to read and write German was what she was doing. Well, I was six, but I went along. Nobody wanted me. My sister kept telling me to get away. I was an embarrassment. Teacher didn't know what to do with me, so she plonked me in a corner and I learned to read and write German. So I still have the book from which I learned to. I mean, I listened and picked it up. Now, we were there for a few months. Christmas came. That was a very sad time because Estonians have some sad songs. And we gathered in a hall somewhere. I hid under the piano. And they were all singing about how I'm born to be a rover, born not to have a home, and this sort of thing. And I'm sitting there howling. My other male cousin, my eldest uncle's son, my father's eldest brother's son, had been conscripted into the German army. You see, the Russians took their conscripts, and then the Germans took their conscripts. And my 18-year-old cousin, Olaf, was actually in Poland. He heard that we were there because the German armies had our names, etc. And so Olaf came to visit us, which was absolutely amazing, round about January, I think. And a couple of months later, we heard that he died in an ambush there. Little group of, his group of soldiers, they had been ambushed by the Russians from all sides.
Can I just ask? Obviously, at that time, you know, death was quite I suppose, what was sort of everyone's attitude to death? Because it was almost so much death. Was it quite unsentimental? Or what was it
well, like? No, I mean, you cry at the loss of people you hold dear. But you can't be, you don't always hear if they died or not. So in Estonia, they didn't know. We did because the army let us know. But things were getting worse and worse. The Russians were approaching, and each morning I would wake up and I would listen. And I was listening for the what I call the distant thunder. It was the battlefront. And you could hear the cannons, and you could hear the rumbling. And each morning it grew louder. And so the men were called in from the forests, and we were told that there would be a train at midnight that would take us out of Oberzitz, take us to a place called Birnbaum, where we would catch another train in 2 days' time that would take us over the Polish border into Germany. So the men are told, it's women and children only. You can't go with them. Well, midnight arrives, no train. 1 a.m. arrives, no train. 2 a.m. arrives, no train. And so on. And meantime, the distant thunder is getting nearer and nearer. The men gather together and they bribe a bunch of Polish farmers to bring their horses and carts, these open-sided carts. I mean, we're in deep snow at this point.
Yeah.
To bring their horses and carts, and they put us in these horses and carts and pay with whatever jewelry anybody has, whatever money anybody has, and as many blankets as possibly could. And we set off across the snowy plains and through forests. Of course, we're like a line of ants in the white of the snow, so we get bombed. And some people die of exposure. I mean, when you've got to pee, you've got to jump off the cart into the snow, undo yourself, pee, and then try to get back before you die. So several people died during the 2 days we were in the horses and carts. At one point, we passed the line of Russian prisoners of war, one of whom overcame a guard, grabbed his gun, and started shooting. So there was shooting going on over our heads. Our driver pulled down the flaps of his cap. He was going back to Poland. You know, he wasn't interested in us anyway. He didn't mind the Russians. And nobody could speak his specific dialect of Polish. So there was another quick whip around to see what money they could get, just to persuade him to take us on. And eventually they succeeded and he took us on. We reached Birnbaum in time, and we reached the train, which was a freight train. You know, the sort with no seats in, just carriages.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was so packed with people. And we were there a couple of days, in fact, in that train. It was so packed with people, I remember lifting my feet off the ground because I thought, you know, I can go to sleep. I don't need to stand on my feet. But when you're swaying between people, even though you're not falling down, it's very uncomfortable.
Sure.
There again, the train would stop periodically. You would jump down and pee, whatever, and then back again. And some more people died on that journey. We made it to Germany. We were in a village at the farm. My mother, my sister, and I. My sister fell ill. And my mother and I were making our way into the village. I think we were trying to barter something for aspirin or whatever for her. We're walking along the railway tracks, and we saw a man stumbling towards us, looking very ragged and very unsteady. And my mother said something about dirty old drunkard. And the man was right on us before we realized it was my father. Because when we had left the town in our horses and carts, the men were kept for a little while later, and then they were told, okay, go save yourselves. Throw your weapons away. Go save yourselves. Well, my father was a farmer. He wasn't going to throw his weapon away. He knew how to use it, so he kept his revolver, and he came in search of us. But the day he found us was the day he was going to blow his brains out, because he'd lost all hope of ever finding us.
Wow.
I mean, where do you go? You try to follow, you're told what went where, etc. But it was a miracle he found us.
Yeah.
From then on, it was easier. Now it's 1945, and it's February. The plan now is to get across Germany to Flensburg, which is on the Danish border, because a school friend of my mother's had moved there before the war, and my mother was still in touch with her. And we had the postcard from her with her address on that my mother had brought from Estonia. Now, here we are making our plans at the railway station when along comes a contingent of officials who say, who are you? Where are you from? Oh, we have the right place for you. And we're taken on board. And when the gates of the concentration camp slam behind us, we realize that we have kind of been captured. It wasn't one of the big ones. And my sister and I could not remember the name of it. My father might have, but he died in 1962. And my mother didn't remember any of these things. So here we are in this concentration camp where they're all sent out to work except for me. But the commandant's assistant was an Estonian woman. She couldn't get out herself, but she tried to get Estonians out of there. And so when she saw the postcard my mother had, she told the commandant that we were expected in Flensburg where there was housing for us and there were jobs for us. So the commandant said, okay, let them go.
So let you go, so, just like that.
Just like that. So,
can I just ask, so you're in a concentration camp in Germany?
Yeah. Oh, wow. But this was within the first few days.
Yeah, yeah.
We weren't supposed to be there. Germany's in a real panic.
Yeah.
Passed Berlin when it was burning from having been bombed on the train at one point. And they really didn't know what they were doing. All these refugees crowding in. And of course, the refugees were all coming from Soviet overtaken lands. So those who were fleeing from Germany were fleeing in other directions, fleeing south, Israel, and so on. Whereas all these refugees, which are now crowding into Germany, aren't really a problem for Germany because we're not going to bomb buildings or do anything like that. But they are a problem in that they need to put us somewhere. So now we're going to hiding. We hide out. We wait in railway stations. Don't know if the trains are going to run or not. But we hide out. We dig up potatoes in the field and cook them. Potatoes with nothing on them. Stick in your throat. Trying to fry potatoes, Bratkartoffeln, without any butter or margarine. I still have that feeling in my throat of where they just stick and stick. And bread we hadn't seen. In Poland, we had, every morning I'd get up in Poland and say, how many pieces of bread can I have today? So food was very, very scarce. But we did eventually, we met up with another Estonian family, which tagged on to us. And we made our way to Flensburg. And we get to Flensburg. The Estonian woman and her family had found for us an abandoned yacht club, which was across the river from them. And it had been closed for the war. So it was empty. So we used a couple of the rooms as bedrooms. And then there was a big hall at the back with changing rooms for them to store their equipment and so on, and the railway line the other side. The adults found jobs in granaries. There were several granaries around there, and they found jobs there, and they would bring handfuls of grain back home, and we'd toast the grain on top of a primer stove and then crunch it. It was like popcorn which hadn't popped. But it was something to eat.
Yeah.
I also chewed dried peas. When I got to Bermuda, my dentist said, I've never seen teeth as flat as yours. And it was because I chewed all these hard things. Yeah. So we were now safe. My job at night and during the day was to walk up and down their railways and pick up any pieces of coal I could find, because we needed that. And also collect cigarette ends, cigarette butts from the street, so that the men could unwrap the remaining tobacco and then use it to make their own roll-up cigarettes.
To use or to sell on?
No, to smoke themselves, because you couldn't buy any. Yeah, my father was a heavy smoker. No, that was it. And I would also raid the waste baskets of offices nearby, because they had beautiful pieces of paper sometimes and carbon copies which were in color. And if I had a whole sheet that was plain, that was treasure. I could draw on it and write on it, etc. So that was a pure joy. And anything that washed up from the water, from the sea, like pencils or other stuff that had fallen off a ship or a ship had been bombed or whatever, pieces of material that my sister made into doll's clothes for me. I didn't have a doll, but I dressed my pillow up as a doll.
See, kids will always find, no matter what the situation, to make the best of what they have, and that's really touching.
Yes, but the worst day there in Flensburg, well, one of the worst days was when some German boys came. We were right on the waterside, and they started collecting jellyfish and chopping them up. And there were these bits of jelly flopping around, and I go in, and my mother serves me sago. I don't know if you've ever had sago, but it
looked
like chopped up jellyfish.
Oh, no.
And I could not eat it. She was furious, and I just vomited it up. I haven't been able to eat anything like that since then.
No.
Okay, but we're I remember, I don't know whether I remember the day the war ended, but I remember the day we heard that Hitler was dead.
Yes.
And then pretty soon after, the British forces moved in.
What was the reaction to that, if I can ask?
I think everything went very quiet.
Yeah.
That's what I remember. I really just see little snippets of film in my mind.
Yeah.
And I think the offices were closed, but that could have been the day the war ended.
Possibly.
My dog is here taking a look.
I love it. Thank you.
My black lab. War ended, we were in the British zone. First sentence of English I was taught, please give me chocolate. So the others who were bigger and bolder actually got chocolate.
Yes.
I would dive and hide. So nobody found me. And I remember the first ice cream. The first ice cream was wonderful. It was actually a water ice, but it was the first thing of that kind that you could get.
Yeah.
What was it like from going from chewing peas and grain to the British arriving with chocolate and ice cream?
Well,
were the British in your mind
very little chocolate and one ice cream?
No, I know, but what
it was like a world opening up.
Yeah, I'd imagine.
Mm-hmm. Not to be afraid anymore. But shortly after this, we are woken up in the morning by bombs exploding. Now the war's ended, and there are slivers of bomb coming in from all sides into the bedroom. And we all rush out in our night clothes with blankets around us and find everybody else in the neighborhood is gathering there too. And some officials are trying to get us organized, trying to find out what's happened. What happened was that there was a store of bombs, bomb storage somewhere nearby, and somebody had dropped the bomb.
And
all went up. So they spend a lot of time making sure that nothing else is going to explode, and they get us together and they start marching us into town, into Flensburg, so across the river and into Flensburg. I have a vest on that I slept in and a blanket around myself. I'm so embarrassed. I don't have any underpants on. I'm 6 years old. This is terrible. But we're all in this state, barefoot. And we get to Flensburg and the British troops are marching in the street, celebrating the king's birthday. Stayed with our friends until it was safe to return to the to the yacht club. And shortly after that, the Allies started gathering people into displaced persons camps, and we got word you had to sign up to them. And we got word that we would go to Neerbeek, which was just west of Hanover. So we went to this village there, Neerbeek, which had been taken from the Germans. The Germans had killed a British flyer who'd landed there or parachuted there. And as punishment for that, the village had been taken away from them and they were forced to live with their relatives outside. So we were in a kind of dangerous zone because they resented us being there very much. But we occupied the whole village. There were Estonians, Lithuanians, Poles, Czechoslovakians, etc. And each family had a room. There were 10 rooms in our house, and each family had one room, and everybody built a little stove, a brick stove in each room. And there was a kitchen that everybody could use, and there was a garden we could share, you know, with apple trees and pear trees. And I had 17 rabbits.
17.
Not intentionally, but
yeah,
17 rabbits at the same time. So we had meat.
How much space did that occupy of the 10 rooms available?
Pardon?
How much space in the house did that occupy with only 10 rooms available?
Oh, no, that was outside.
Kept in the garden.
The rabbit hatches were outside.
Apologies.
Mm-hmm. Right. Somebody had a pig too. And we weren't supposed to have pigs. We weren't allowed to have livestock. So when the house was inspected on one famous occasion, somebody stuck the pig on a toilet, put a hat on it, and the inspector went, "Oh, sorry, Mom."
No, that is
a friend of mine wrote this in her recorded this in her autobiography because I had forgotten about I knew about the pig, but I'd forgotten about that. When we did eventually eat the pig, everybody got a cut.
You ate it in the end. Now,
all the nationalities there started their own schools and their own workshops. The men started doing, and my father was very handy with woodwork and so on. They started making beautiful jewelry boxes. They started doing leather stuff where you you used the leather to, I don't know how to describe it, you stuff it with, you stuff patterns into it with cotton wool in there and so on. And so there were these things they could sell. And we started getting food from the UNRRA and the Red Cross. And always a big day when those arrived, those came. And that's where I started school. Estonians attend school from 7 onwards. Age of 7.
That's quite late. Well, later.
Oh, yeah. By the second term, they're already on cursive handwriting and so on, because you learn very fast at that age.
Yeah.
So I obviously knew how to read and write before because I learned the German for it. My sister thinks she taught me. She doesn't think my mother did. She says she taught herself. But there we are. I loved school.
Yeah.
Then in 1947, the nations again got together and tried to clear Germany of refugees. So as there were some 850,000 of us in the various camps, never mind the ones who hadn't signed up and who were trying to exist out of sight.
Yeah.
And there were 5 countries which opened their doors. The US reluctantly, Canada reluctantly, Sweden, Australia, and the UK. Now, in 1947, I'd say the US and Canada reluctantly, because you had to have people in the US or Canada who would pay for you.
Ah, okay.
So if you didn't have anyone to support you, as the some of the Jews from New York said, oh, I remember that time because we all collected our money together to get as many Jews out as possible.
Oh, yeah. That's why Sony went to New York.
Yes. Yeah. So that left us with two choices. If the war started up again, and anything could happen, Sweden was too near. If Estonia were freed, Australia was too far. So that left us with the UK. And the men and single women were sent ahead to get jobs. My father was sent to a farm to get jobs, learn the language, get some means of supporting the family. And the family would follow the next year.
Whereabouts was this? Did he work? Whereabouts in Britain did he work?
Somewhere, I can't remember. I can't remember because he was, all I wanted was the parcels he sent us back.
Yeah.
Oranges, for instance, were on ration. But he would send us his ration back, and there might be two oranges in that box that was on top of the cupboard that I was longing for, absolutely longing for. And he sent me a pair of sandals, which were too big and gave me blisters.
Yeah.
But they were grand. My sister had been at the boarding school, a weekly boarding school, which they set up for the teenagers, so didn't see much of her. And after my father left, somebody finally took my mother seriously. She'd been dragging me from doctor to doctor saying, this child has a cough that won't go away. And they said, oh, look at her pink cheeks. Nothing wrong with this child.
No.
They finally took an x-ray. I had tuberculosis.
Oh, wow.
Which was very bad at that time, very bad. And I was sent off to a sanatorium. I was there for 6 months. I remember nothing of it. And I can only tell I was there 6 months because my school report shows that I missed after school year.
Wow.
So after that, as you couldn't get to England if you had TB and you got checked, we were dead scared that I would be found to still have it or whatever. And we had to go through two transit camps, and we were several months in the first one, and we got really worried. That's where I did meet somebody who had been on the Moira, the ship that sank, she and her children and her husband. And the only person they had lost was the baby who was strapped to her husband's back.
Okay.
Very sad.
Yeah.
Well, eventually, after two transit camps, we made it and being tested for TB, etc. Nobody checked up on me because of the pink cheeks, etc. So I don't know whether I still had signs or not, but certainly cleared up once I got to England. Mm. And then we had to. We were in a camp there where they organized the school for us in Corsham, in Wiltshire. Of course, we all spoke German.
Yeah.
All nationalities, we all spoke German, which confused the teachers who were English heck of a lot. But we all attended the cinema across the road too, and we learned a lot of English from Tarzan films. And I remember one that was called The Gorilla. And of course, to me, a gorilla was a gorilla, and I wasn't thinking of the spies, the soldiers that my father had been watching out for in Poland. I waited the whole film. There was no gorilla in it.
You think you'd gone into the wrong, disappointing. The room.
Yeah. Wrong spelling. So from then on, my parents wanted to work together and to have housing. And that was difficult, that limited the number of jobs you could get. Well, what had happened was that, of course, all the servants from the big houses had gone to war, had either been killed or came back and expected better jobs. So my parents put themselves up as housekeeper and cook and butler.
Yeah.
Went into domestic service. My mother was a fantastic cook. Just show her a picture and she can do it. So we lived in a number of grand places. The first place was Westerbird School, which is a boarding school. I didn't go to the school. I went to the Tetbury Church of England primary. But we lived in this grand building, and then we moved to Gloucestershire at Great Rollright Manor, which was owned by the parents of the present Duchess of Devonshire. Amanda, the Duchess, was about 5 years old when we moved there. I was about 11. So she loved to have me read to her and bath her as well. She didn't want her nanny. Still remember that, yeah. From there, we went to Lym Castle and so on. And then a council house. That was a come down. But the thing was that although I was too old to take the 11 plus in my first year in England, I just couldn't, I didn't understand the paper at all. When they put me into a secondary modern, the next year, the teachers there said she needs to take the 11 plus. She doesn't belong here. And so I had the 11 plus later. I got on the borderline. The grammar school headmaster wanted to meet with me. And I remember he said to me, "What do you want to be when you grow up?" And I said, "An authoress." No one had ever said that to him before.
No.
So that was it. I was lucky in that I went through the grammar school system. I went through the university. My sister, who was 17 when we got to England, her schooling was all disregarded. She had to go out to work.
Yeah.
So she had to go out to work and leave her family and learn things on her own.
Age 17.
Yeah.
That's only a year older than we are now.
A lot. And it haunted those who were maybe a year or two older than me as well.
Yeah.
But they didn't have this chance, no matter how intelligent they were, they didn't have it.
No.
But I've always been grateful to the UK for taking us. And when a few years later, the Hungarian Revolution happened and we got Hungarian refugees who came in and demanded, "I'm a doctor, I expect to have a job as a doctor," etc., etc. I thought, where's your gratitude?
Yeah.
Stop that. Yeah. So that's it, really.
Really? And can I just ask, how did you come to live in Bermuda? How did that happen?
I applied for a job.
Ah.
My tutor at university had said, never stay more than 3 years in your first job. He said, no matter how much you love it or hate it, 3 years. And then you move, otherwise you never learn. So I taught in Leicestershire for 3 years, and then I applied for a few things that I didn't get and came up this thing in Bermuda, and I just thought, well, I'll never get that. Stuck my application in the post and forgot all about it.
Yeah.
Next thing I knew, I get the thick envelope, wad of papers, with a letter saying, "I'm much impressed by your application."
Yeah. And you moved there?
Yep. Here to teach French.
Have you ever been back to Estonia, to Poland, to Germany?
Because Estonia, well, the Baltic states, I keep saying the war, as World War II there, didn't end until 1991. Yeah, when the Soviets quit.
Soviet Union, yeah.
Yeah. And my sister and I went back in 92. And very little had changed in the 50 years or so.
Yeah.
We went to what used to be my uncle's farm, my uncle Richard's farm, my father's second brother. my cousin lived there now, and it was exactly the same.
Yeah.
There had been no modernization of any sort. I said, okay, that building's shorter. And they said, yes, we took a part of it off.
Yeah.
No modernization because they'd all been taken over and made into coal houses.
Yeah, Soviet.
You know, where they all work, the community work together, and she had had trouble getting it back. When we, there was practically no food.
No.
We had a hard time finding anything to eat in restaurants. Or even getting into restaurants. Oh no, we closed. We closed 5 minutes ago.
Yeah.
Sandwich or something, no. We went back in 98, 6 years later, and things had changed a lot.
Yeah, give it a bit of time after the end. And I'd
yes, so. Because once the Estonians had it to themselves, investors came in. Mm. Investors flooded in. In fact, I have friends here who work for companies which moved to Estonia. And things were much, much better in 98.
Yeah.
And we met up with a second cousin that my sister had managed to get in touch with, the nephew of the soldier who died in Poland, Thomas and his wife. And when they came to meet us at the hotel, it turned out that they were the ones whose father or grandfather had picked up our photo albums, the albums that mother had pulled some sheets out of. They picked up the photo albums and taken them home with them in case the Russians used them to identify people. They had come in that the night following our departure, the two brothers, my father's two brothers, with a horse and cart, and they lowered furniture down from the windows and taken anything that had any bearing on who we were. And some of that furniture was in my cousin's farm and was in the room in which we slept on our first visit, my sister and I, which was really very strange. There was a wardrobe with an oval mirror. And I remember my father picking me up when I was about 2 years old and showing me what I looked like. He just cut all my hair off, as was the custom in those days to encourage adult hair to grow through. You know, you have your baby hair. And of course your own hair grows through, but to encourage it, I think it was a Russian custom too. They cut all my hair off. I remember cramming my straw hat on so the little boys wouldn't see that I was bald.
Nah.
So, yeah. But anyway, that wardrobe was there at the farm.
Wow.
Been back quite a few times now, and my second cousin Thomas and his wife have been here, and I've had other Estonians here. The NatWest International Games, International Island Games, were held here in 2013, and an Estonian contingent came out here, and I was put in charge of them. They'd never had an Estonian before anywhere, which was wonderful. Some of them have been back.
Okay. That's wonderful. That's brilliant. Are we good to wrap up? Or do you have any more to say?
I can go on for hours, but...
we are sort of limited on time, but yeah. Go on, Jenna, why don't you wrap up?
Honestly,
Do you want any pictures?
Yes. Can we do that at the end? I'll just wrap up now and finish recording.
Yeah, and well, I'll email you some pictures.
That would be amazing. Brilliant.
Okay.
Oh,
lovely to see you
pictures.
Guys.
I thought you meant us takes for that would be absolutely amazing. Okay. I'm left speechless, to be honest. You have lived through so many different lives all in one. I don't really know how to describe it. You're just such a fascinating person. Thank you so much for sharing your lifetime worth of stories with us.
My pleasure. The thing is that it does it does depend on your perspective. The Russians weren't all bad.
No.
And the Germans weren't all bad, but it depends on your experience with them.
Exactly.
Do you know a novel by Ian Sirayya called The Silver Sword?
I do not.
It used to be very popular perhaps 25 years ago or so. I found myself teaching it when I sub for somebody. And it deals with Polish children whose parents have been taken by the Germans. And they give pursuit. They try to track down their parents. And they reach the same camp that I was in Poznan. Poznan, it's actually mentioned there, and I said to these 10-year-olds, well, I was actually there. Now, who's bad, who's good? When I was there, it was in German hands, and they were helping us. When the children reached there, it's in Russian hands, and the Russians are helping them.
Yeah.
So it all depends on your experiences, and they went home.
We've loved hearing about your experiences, really, really have.
Yeah. Well, they went home and they talked to their parents. And that was good because the parents got back to me and said, we had a really good discussion.
Oh, we would love you as our sub teacher or teacher. That'd be amazing. thank you so much for coming on.
My pleasure. I'll be following you guys.
Thank you very much.